Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is David Thoreau, and I'm the president of the Independent Institute. I'm delighted to welcome all of you to our program this evening. As you know, the title of it is The Truth About Medical Marijuana. We're delighted that our program tonight is also co-sponsored by our friends at Harper's Magazine, the Drug Policy Alliance, and the Richard and Rhoda Goldman School of Public Policy at the University of California in Berkeley. The Independent Institute regularly sponsors the Independent Policy Forum, a series of lectures, seminars, and debates held here in the San Francisco Bay Area. In all of our programs, we seek to get beyond the stereotypes of left and right and feature speakers who will present their own views so that we all have a better opportunity to make up our own minds. For those of you who are new to the Independent Institute, the Institute is a nonprofit public policy research organization. We sponsor and publish many books and other publications and conduct many conference and media programs like our program tonight. We also invite you to visit us at our website, which is at independent.org. You'll find further information about our many publications, including our journal, which is called the Independent Review. It's a quarterly journal, and there are copies out in the front if you'd like to pick up one or get an idea of what it's about. You're also welcome to receive our free weekly email newsletter, which is called The Lighthouse. The Lighthouse will keep you up to date on many policy issues, as well as advise you on upcoming Institute events and other programs. And to do so, be sure to leave your contact information, including your email address, before you leave after our program tonight. Our next event, I want to mention, is going to be held on November 13th. It will be held at the Independent Institute's Conference Center, which is located in Oakland, just off of Route 880 by the Oakland Airport. The topic will be the USA Patriot Act and the assault on civil liberties. The program is being organized by our Center on Peace and Liberty and will feature Margaret Russell, who's chairman of the ACLU of Northern California and professor of law at Santa Clara University, David Cole from Georgetown University Law Center, and best-selling author James Bovard. We hope that all of you will be able to join with us. Also, in the program handout that hopefully everyone got, you'll find information about the Institute itself, and we hope that each of you will join as an Institute associate member and become more directly involved in the battle over issues such as what we'll be addressing this evening. To set the stage for tonight's discussion, I want to mention a few developments that are worth noting. Articles today in Reuters, the New York Daily News, and USA Today now corroborate a major new National Enquirer story that Rush Limbaugh, the influential talk show host and highly vocal supporter of the war on drugs, is under criminal investigation by the State Attorney General of Florida for his buying and mega-consuming of thousands of addictive painkillers from a black market drug ring over the past 4 years. If true, how again do you spell hypocrisy? In 1996, California voters passed Proposition 215, allowing physicians to recommend marijuana for medical purposes. To date, as I understand, 10 states have enacted medical marijuana legislation that is actually being implemented. And a total of 36 states in the District of Columbia have formally recognized in various ways the value of medical marijuana. A year ago, the Ninth Circuit, U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals ruled that doctors have a constitutional right to discuss marijuana with their patients. However, refusing to accept the will of the electorate, the federal government has been fighting back. Earlier this year, Oakland resident Ed Rosenthal was the central target of the federal government's campaign to destroy legal medical marijuana in California. The case and subsequent verdict against Rosenthal was based on withholding key information from the jury, including the fact that Mr. Rosenthal had been deputized by the city of Oakland under California law, specifically to attend to the seriously ill. In the case, Mr. Rosenthal faced a sentence of 60 years in federal prison. However, facing subsequent public outrage about the case, including a public protest by the juries themselves, the presiding judge handed down a sentence of only one day in jail and a nominal fine. But Ed Rosenthal remains a convicted felon who is currently seeking to have his sentence overturned in a state with three strikes and you're out. Interestingly enough, in the current recall election in California, all of the major candidates from across the political spectrum, including those that have dropped out, have endorsed the legality of medical marijuana. How times change. Clearly, this is a reflection of the fact that over 70% of the public supports medical marijuana. Not to be discouraged, however, the Department of Justice has since asked the U.S. Supreme Court to allow it to punish medical doctors who recommend marijuana, and the DEA continues to raid and close down clinics. Meanwhile, Congressman Barney Frank and Sam Farr have each submitted bills respectively to reduce the federal classification of marijuana, to decriminalize its medicinal use, and to allow defendants in federal cases to claim compliance with state laws. Unfortunately, neither bill probably has much chance yet of passage. There are many questions to ask about federal policies, state policies, who benefits, who loses. Is California leading the nation? What kind of views are actually being presented and based on what? And what about the lives of the people who are suffering from cancer, AIDS, MS, and many other serious ailments? What happens to them in the meantime? Our independent policy forum this evening assembles several of the foremost experts to discuss the past, present, and future of medical marijuana. So I'd like to introduce our speakers. Please hold your applause until I complete the introduction. First, to my left, your right, is Ed Rosenthal, the noted activist and best-selling author who's been a key pioneer, as you all know, of the movement for medical marijuana. In 30 years of study, writing, and activism, he's become a trusted expert on marijuana use and social policy. He's also co-author of the important book which you're featuring this evening called Why Marijuana Should Be Legal, and there are copies on the front table. And he's written over a dozen other books on the subject. To his left, again, your right, is Donald Abrams. Ron McCoon. Rob is professor of law and public policy at the Goldman School of Public Policy at the University of California, Berkeley, and co-author of the other book that we are featuring this evening called Drug War Heresies from Cambridge University Press. He was formerly a behavioral scientist at the Institute for Civil Justice and the Drug Policy Research Center at RAND Corporation. He's one of the world's foremost authorities on drug policy. To my right is Edwin Dobb. Ed is contributing editor to Harper's Magazine. His writings on civil liberties have been published in Harper's, Amnesty Now, and San Francisco Magazine. He was formerly senior editor of The Sciences. He writes for New York Times Magazine and is a visiting lecturer at the Graduate School of Journalism, also at UC Berkeley. Finally, I want to introduce to his right, your left again, Donald Abrams. Don is professor of clinical medicine at the University of California here in San Francisco and one of the leading researchers in the world on medical marijuana. He's also assistant director of the AIDS program at San Francisco General Hospital, and since 1981 has been involved in several landmark studies on HIV and AIDS. He's conducted clinical trials of marijuana since 1997, including trials with grants from the National Institute of Health. So please join with me in welcoming our speakers. Before we begin, a couple of quick program matters I want to mention. After our discussion, we will have questions from the audience. And in the program that each of you have, there should be a question card. Please just jot down your question during the presentations, and there'll be people circulating the aisles to pick up the cards for the Q&A period. In addition, after the Q&A period, we will adjourn, and Mr. Rosenthal and Mr. McCoon will be available to autograph copies of their books in the front lobby where you registered. So without further ado, I'm very pleased to introduce Ed Rosenthal.
To thank the Independent Institute for sponsoring this forum and creating it, and I think that this is pretty incredible, and especially you, David, and also Bill Sandover, who's here. They've just done so much work in getting this together. Inspiring. And I'd like to thank everybody who's here, and in fact the entire community, because the reason why I am here and can be here tonight is because I was only given a one-day sentence, and that is because of you. It wasn't because of the judge, it wasn't because of, you know, any of the legal things, it was because of the pressure that the community and the media placed on the court system. So I'd like to give you a hearty thanks for that. This issue, the issue of medical marijuana, is of prime importance to perhaps 100,000 Californians who use marijuana in one way or another for their health, who have been given recommendations by doctors. And it may improve the quality of their life, it may maintain their health, or it may actually keep them alive. And so this is not just a ruse issue or something like that. And this issue not only affects Californians, but also throughout the nation. And there are probably somewhere between 500,000 and 1 million people who use marijuana medically, whether or not they have a recommendation for it. Now, I'd like to go into a little bit about my case. As you know, I was convicted on 3 counts, and that is cultivating marijuana, maintaining a place where marijuana is cultivated, and also conspiracy to cultivate marijuana. And as you know, this was a result of a jury that was kept ignorant of the facts of the case, that I was deputized by the city of Oakland, that I was providing medical marijuana, that I was told by the city that I was immune from prosecution. And once a jury found this out, when they went home and read the newspapers that they hadn't been reading while they were jurors, within hours they got back to the media and repudiated their sentence. And of course that did not have a judicial meaning, but it certainly had a meaning to the media, and it certainly had a meaning to the public. Because, you know, this case was not fought just on one level. It was fought on 2 levels. And that is, it was fought in the court, and so far we're losing the court case, but in the court of public opinion, we're the winners. And I want to mention something. You know, most of us, you know, when we vote, we realize we're minority voters in one way or another. We vote for all these candidates that don't win quite a bit of the time, and we vote for causes that seem to be lost causes, but we're the majority. When it comes to medical marijuana, we are the majority. Anybody who's opposed to it, they're in the minority. It's a very unusual position to be in, at least for me. And for most of us, I think. But we have to realize that we're not talking, we're not trying to convince people that medical marijuana is efficacious or that it works or that it should be legal. We're just trying to convince a few politicians of it who are being wagged by the tail. And I'll get into that. Actually, 8 of the jurors repudiated the verdict, two of the alternates. This had never happened before in American history. Now, I noticed that it's heating up because the jury in the Oakland case, 6 members of the jury in the Oakland case, complained that I'm talking about the Riders case, have just complained about the what happened in their jury. So 4 days after the jury convicted me, they were back in the courtroom in the audience section for the judge to look at while he was deciding whether I was going to be remanded into custody immediately. Now, I know that most of you were very relieved that I was given only a one-day sentence 6 months later, but I was more ambivalent about it because, well, you know, it's pretty good getting a one-day sentence, and actually the government owes me 12 hours because I served 36 hours. But let's say they had given me 5 years and remanded me to prison right then and there. You know, it would have been a lot more headlines. I would have had a book sold by now on this. And I think it would have moved the laws. And I think that the government and the judge realized that if he had done that, that it would have caused quite a bit more, controversy. Right now, the government is appealing my sentence. And they want me to do the 21 months or 5 years or whatever. And I'm appealing the conviction both on technical and on constitutional grounds. And I wanted to go through them because they're of importance. And the first is that the judge, in pretrial, the judge was looking at the search warrant and he realized that the DEA agent Pickett had lied on the search warrant. So instead of allowing a withering cross-examination, he said, well, I'm just going to excise certain parts of the search warrant. And what was left after he excised everything was that I had a high electric bill. And then my attorney said, well, let's compare with other electric bills in the area. And the judge said, I'm not going to allow it because there are industrial users in the area, and then the search warrant might not be good. So we're appealing on that basis. Then we're appealing because the judge found that the prosecutor had actually lied to the grand jury. And the judge found that he had misled the grand jury. But the judge said that no harm was done. And I don't know, if we had lied, if one of you had lied to the grand jury, you would be up for perjury. And here, the prosecutor is lying to the grand jury. And he shouldn't have even been testifying. So those are the two technical grounds that we're appealing on. And we may very well win on those grounds. If we win, for instance, on the first one, it would mean that the way that search warrants are looked at would change. It would change, it would have court precedent there. But there are other more important issues that we're covering. And I'm going to go through these very quickly. The first is the Ninth Amendment. Now, you know, the Ninth Amendment has never been used in court work, or it's been used for very little. Even the Griswold decision, which was for birth control, and the abortion decisions, did not rely on the Ninth Amendment. And what the Ninth Amendment says is that those rights of the people that are not enumerated in the Constitution remain with the people and shall not be denigrated. That means, like, for instance, you have the right to eat strawberries. There's nothing in the Constitution that says that you have an inherent right to eat strawberries, but you have it because it's been there. Those are some of your natural rights. And there are two natural rights that the Ninth Amendment covers in this case. And the first is that you have a right to seek health. Everybody has a right to seek health in their own way, whether you want to use herbal supplements, or whether you want to use vitamins, or whether you want to use religion and prayer for your health. You have a right to determine how you will gain your health. And so by restricting medical marijuana, the government is restricting your right to health. And then the second part is this. Before the Constitution, people in the United States had the right to use marijuana. And then, up until 1937, there were no federal laws against marijuana. So that was 150 years that people were using, approximately 150 years during the United States that people were using marijuana. Then in 1937, the government realized that in order to restrict marijuana, it would have to pass a constitutional amendment. So instead, they passed a tax law that was confiscatory. It was a $100 an ounce tax, which in 1937 was a lot, since an ounce only cost a couple of dollars. So people would be arrested not for possessing marijuana, but for not possessing the tax stamp or paying the taxes on the substance. And it wasn't until 1968 that marijuana was made illegal. I believe that that's unconstitutional. People had the right to use marijuana through that entire period of time, and it was only in 1968 that it was made illegal. Well, if people had the right to use it, then that was a constitutional right. How can that be denied? And this, you know, years ago I wrote a paper that said that the Ninth Amendment is probably going to be the amendment of the 21st century, and I hope this is the first case on it. Then the Tenth Amendment, that's our states' rights amendment, that any rights not given to the federal government remain with the states. And the state has two basic rights, one in this area. One is to regulate the health of its citizens, and the other is to regulate doctors. So the federal government is violating these rights in terms of the Tenth Amendment. And where this comes in, especially in my particular case, is in the Constitution, and these are interwoven, but in the Commerce Clause of the Constitution that regulates interstate commerce. Well, look, this marijuana was grown in California by Californians, for Californians. It was recommended by a California doctor for people to use in California. I fail to see where there's any interstate commerce. So if there's no interstate commerce, and the state has the right to regulate health, and it's already determined that marijuana is good medicine, then why is the federal government in here at all? And then another issue is 885D. And 885D says that it's a federal law, and it's part of the Controlled Substances Act. And it says that if you're a federal, state, or city health and safety officer, and you're in the course of your business, you're dealing with controlled substances, you're immune from prosecution. Well, that's so that narcs can buy and sell pot and other drugs and not get arrested for it. And I was a health and safety officer that the city of Oakland had appointed. And I was told by the city attorney's office that I was immune from prosecution under this law. So that, Judge Breyer said that a literal reading of this would seem to immunize Rosenthal from prosecution. But then he said, I'm not going to allow that. And then he didn't allow the jury to hear it. And then there's the other thing. Let's say the city attorney was wrong. Let's say the city attorney's office was totally wrong, and they had told me that I was immune from prosecution, but I wasn't. Well, then I should have been immune from prosecution because of estoppel, which means that if you're told that something that you're doing is okay by the federal government, they can't then come in and say, look, it isn't right, you're breaking the law, and you're under arrest. And that's the idea of estoppel. So I was, needless to say, I was a little surprised when I was arrested. And as you know, I never felt guilty. I'll tell you why I did this. You know, first of all, I'm a successful writer, which is pretty unusual in America. And I own my own publishing company. And so I'm a upper middle class or a middle class person. And I did not have to get involved in this. This was not my source of income. And the reason why I got involved in it was because the city of Oakland asked me to help patients. And, you know, there are all kinds of sins in life. And we read about most of them that come out of the Ten Commandments in the daily papers, you know, based on lust, greed, robbery, lying, just basically the administration. So you look at that, but... But then there are other sins too, and sort of sins of omission. What when you see somebody who needs help and you say, I'm not going to render that person help, that's a sin. That's a sin as much as lusting after somebody else's wife or husband or whatever. So I felt, you know, I was living with this, and then when the city said, well, you have immunity, well, I had no excuse not to do it. And then there were personal things like, let's see, I can legally grow pot. Just the thought of that. You know, I should say that, you know, they say that the federal government says that pot's addictive. Well, I don't think that marijuana is really addictive, but growing it is. And so when I was given the opportunity to legally grow marijuana, I jumped at that. So anyway, so given that, it was, given all these circumstances, it was inevitable that when I was arrested, that I would be fighting, this. And I had just read a book a few months before I was arrested called The Tipping Point, which talks about movements and how movements form and how little things make big changes in society. And I think I was really fortunate in reading this book because it gave me insight into what was going to happen to me, what was happening to me, and what was going to happen to this issue. And after all of this, you know, the one thing that this did was change the paradigm in the way that people think about marijuana and that the way the press reports it. And this is exactly what the federal government was afraid of. This is what they've been trying to stop. And their doing this actually made me into a much better activist than I've ever been. You know, one of my ironic thoughts is that for 35 years I was trying to think, well, what would make me a more effective activist? How can I be a more effective activist? How can I get this into the media so I could be speaking at places like the Independent Institute instead of at mass rallies and things? So, and the federal government found it out for me. And, you know, so let this be a warning. You better be careful what you wish for. So, now, the real question is, why does the federal government want to do this? What's their, what do they have in it? What's their vested interest in this? And I want to go into my, I have two ideas about this. The first is that they really hate marijuana more than any other drug, more whether it's legal or illegal. And the reason for that, whether you're talking about tobacco, alcohol, amphetamines, cocaine, heroin, all of those drugs ultimately make you dysfunctional in one way or another, or can kill you, you know. And the problem with marijuana, as far as the police are concerned, is that there is no payback to the people. They don't get any dysfunction from it. They might be happier than the police are. It doesn't fit the Puritan ethic that if you have enjoyment, that in some way you have to pay for it. And I think, in a way, that's the psychology of the police. But there's something much more important, that the whole criminal justice industry is based on arrests and on catching criminals. And so if you decriminalized or regulated marijuana, then 8% of their budget would be down the drain. 8% of their budget, one out of every 12 arrests, one out of every 12 jails, one out of every 12 cop cars, one out of every 12 judges. You know, it goes on and on down the line, so that we're talking about a tremendous amount of money. And the marijuana war costs the federal government and you, federal government and the state governments, that means us, really, somewhere between $15 and $30 billion a year. And I'll give you some quick statistics on that. There are about 730,000 people were arrested for marijuana last year, 88% of them for simple possession. There are probably between 100 and 150,000 people in prison right now for marijuana. There are 20,000 people in federal prison for marijuana right now. Cost the government $1.5 billion just to house a small town of 20,000 people. Half of those people are Hispanic, so that there are 10,000 Hispanic people in prison, in federal prison, just for marijuana. And, you know, so if you can think of how much resources is spent on that, it's incredible. So let's give a hypothetical. Let's say tomorrow everybody stopped using illegal drugs, or let's say they just stopped using marijuana. Everybody stopped using marijuana. So the police went out to arrest people. There was nobody to arrest. Nobody was selling marijuana on the street. Nobody was using it in their homes. It wasn't being used. It would be disaster for the DEA. Could you imagine that? Now look, DEA has had a pretty good growth period over the last 65 years. In 1937, when the tax stamp came in, there were estimated to be 55,000 users. Last year there were 730,000 arrests. That's about 13. The arrests totaled 13 times the number of users when marijuana was originally regulated. There are 25 million users for the feds and state authorities to poach upon. They've had a tremendous success. You know, if you take a look at these statistics, statistical impossibility is going to happen sometime around 2020, where there'll actually be more marijuana users in the United States than there are people. So, let's see. Now, I wanted to step back for a moment from this and get into what this is all about. And, you know, let's say we were talking about a river and how we were going to use this river. And, you know, there'd be all the stakeholders in this river, and the water that this river provided would get together and talk about it. You know, you might have farmers and urban people and urban communities and environmentalists, and maybe there would be fishermen might get involved in it. And together they'd reach some sort of compromise that probably nobody would like, but that everybody could live with or sort of live with. But so let's look at the stakeholders in terms of medical marijuana. Well, you have patients, you have the doctors, you have the providers, you have the caregivers, you have manufacturers, and all of these people have something to lend to the discussion. You have a public health service, they might have something to say about it. All insurers might have something to say about it because they might have to pay for it. But where are the police in this? Where's the criminal justice system in this? What's their stake in this? They claim to have a stake in that. What do they have a right to poach upon people, to poach upon sick people? Just what is their stake in it? And this is the problem. Their stake in this is arrests. They need arrests, or else they can't justify their budgets. And that's what this whole thing is all about. And that's why this is a... We will hear later that this is a culture war, and this is part of the culture war. Whether they have a right to arrest a certain group of people because they're using this substance just so that they can arrest them. Can you imagine all of the wasted resources of this? The thousands and thousands of people whose lives are being ruined. 750,000 people were arrested. 730,000 people were arrested last year. That doesn't affect just 730,000 people. It affects millions of people. It affects their families. It affects their employers. It might affect their employees. It affects them if they're college students, because they lose all federal ability for federal grants. So that 730,000 arrests, and it doesn't stop at the end of the year. Okay, this 730,000 is processed, we'll do the next. It continues all their lives. They might lose professional licenses. They might lose the ability to continue with their education. So when we step back and we see who are the stakeholders, here's what I think. The police the criminal justice system is not a stakeholder in whether medical marijuana patients should be able to use marijuana, or how much they should be able to use, or how they should be able to grow it. They have absolutely no expertise in this area. Any expertise that they claim to have is negated by their official organization. And their official organization is the California Narcotics Officers Association. You can go onto the internet and look at their position papers. And here's what they say. Marijuana is not a medicine. These people are verbal terrorists. Now, the reason why I say they're verbal terrorists, in order to remain a police officer in California, you have to continually get education. You have to take educational classes. And the California Narcotics Officers Association is deputized to give some of these classes. So what this is what they're teaching their students, which is police, that marijuana isn't a medicine, that anybody who's using it as a ruse. Don't believe it. Bust them now and let the court sort it out. And they're giving a training session in case anybody on November 8th through 13th. I'm going to try and register for it. And the people who are supporting medical marijuana are just doing it as a means of pushing marijuana onto the public, you know, so that this is the first step. This is the only thing that I agree with them about, that medical marijuana is only a first step, because everybody has a right to use it, whether they're using it medically or recreationally or however they want to use it. And I know that the Narcotics Officers Association will say, well, that's exactly what we said. But let's get real. Does the federal government differentiate between medical marijuana and recreational marijuana? There's no differentiation in the law. And in fact, what do they tell the juries? No matter what the state law might be, the federal government doesn't recognize medical marijuana. So you have this Narcotics Officers Association functioning as verbal terrorists in this war. And then they want to sit down at the table with stakeholders and say, well, we're stakeholders in it too. But I question, where is their stake in it? And I'll give you one example of how this played out very recently. There was recently the Vasconcellos bill, which former Governor Davis is going to decide whether he's going to sign or not. Part of the reason he's going to be former Governor Davis is because he was always apathetic and actually anti-marijuana and anti-medical marijuana. And maybe if he had a little more empathy for a few sick people, he wouldn't be in the terrible position that he's in. But, okay, so anyway, this Vasconcellos bill, what this bill originally said, it adopted the SAM, the Sonoma guidelines, which were 99 plants and 100 or 200 square feet. Well, after it was ready to go right into the Senate, what happened was Lochner got a hold of Vasconcellos and they changed it to 6 plants. Now, what expertise does Lochner have about what 6 plants will produce? What does he know about medicine? Why was he even involved in it? Don't you think it's up for the people of this state to make policy and then for the Attorney General and the district attorneys to follow that policy and for the police to follow it, rather than for the tail to wag the dog? That's where it's at. We have a police department that is out of control. And I have to get off, but there's one last part of this, which is, if you look at the Oakland Narcotics Bureau, where do you think they're housed? They're not in the Oakland Police Building. They're not at City Hall. They're not in any of their own building. No, they have a space in the federal building. And narcotics divisions all over the country are becoming part of the national police They're being directed more by the federal government, by their than by their local police chiefs, and they are now becoming part of the anti-terror network, and that's what we're dealing with. We have a big job ahead of us, but we will win this. Here's something for us all to say and think about. These laws are doomed. Thank you.
Just add as a footnote to what Ed's been saying is there's a school of economics that we use it in part at the Independent Institute called the School of Public Choice, and public choice economists are very well aware of what Ed is talking about as far as the incentives that police agencies have in fostering and actually criminalizing behavior for their own benefit. I want to thank Ed for a wonderful presentation.